the way we started the podcast was we sell to a lot of jewelers, and they don't, their staff doesn't know much about color gemstones. Mm-hmm. And so we had someone say, listen, there's no podcasts on gemstones. You guys should just go downstairs in the basement and like talk into a microphone and tell us what you know about gemstones, and people will listen. And
we
then
said they will.
And we said, are you sure? And so then it kind of morphed into this thing, and we haven't even been doing it a year yet, but it's...
What is it? March?
March of... Yeah, it was after March. the shows last year.
I believe you guys are the best one out there. I think y'all are killing it.
Welcome to another episode of Gem Junkies. I'm Brecken.
I'm Jonathan.
We have a very special guest with us today.
William Travis Kukovich.
And he is a super cool designer, and we get to hear all about his life story and share it with him. I mean...
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on Gem Junkie.
I mean, I laugh because I'm like, is it an honor? But yeah, it is.
I thought you were laughing because I got it wrong.
No,
it is Gem Junkie, right? I mean, this is Gem Junkie.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And
you want to see the scars from it? I mean, can you see this? How bad they still are to this day? Yeah. So this entire part of my brain was completely smashed in. So all of this was caved in and then brought up and rebuilt. And because I was so young, they stapled the bone together and it grew back together. But these are, and of course, when I had more hair, you couldn't see them as open. But, you know, unlike this.
So you were 4 years old.
4 years old.
What happened?
I was riding in the back of a truck.
Okay.
A pickup truck.
Yep.
Going down the road, and there's a whole story about how I fell out, but I fell out.
Yeah.
Going about 65 miles an hour on a paved road.
Oh, jeez, that gave me the chills.
Yeah.
Oh.
It was bad. I scarred up badly, but, and they all thought I would die.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, the family all came in, but I didn't die. And when I came out of it, I was in a coma for a long time. You know, my brain was
resetting.
Yeah. And it rewired, and they actually, I believe if it wasn't for my mother, they wouldn't have tried so hard to keep me alive. I think that it was a pull-the-plug situation, and my mother said
no
for a short, for a couple of days there, and then I started doing better, you know, right away.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knows why you do better. Obviously, I don't remember much
of it.
I remember the entire truck episode. I remember what I was doing, where I was sitting.
And you were four.
I was four.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Well, it was a
traumatic episode.
There were things that were happening there in my life. We had just gone to the trash dump. I had found an old television and taken these TV tubes out of it. Do you know what those are?
Yeah.
And I thought they were super cool. And because they were like these little glass things with like a city inside of them. And I had just seen a conductor on television for the first time the night before. And so I turned a No. 9 washtub upside down like the conductor stood on. And I pushed it up against the cab of the truck. And I stood there and took two sticks. And I conducted my brother as he sang like a rhinestone cowboy up against the back of the truck. You know, I fell right out the back. And my mom said she looked in the rearview mirror when Troy started screaming. And I looked like, you know, a rag doll, just like I was doing
tumbling
head over feet without my hands.
Oh, my gosh.
And luckily, our neighbors were coming down the same road, and they snatched me up while my mother was in shock and threw me in
the car
and drove me straight to the hospital. Who knows why I didn't die, but like I said, for sure, I know all those doctors because they, I mean, small town America. To this day, still can't believe that I survived that.
Yeah. And but, what you can do now. I mean, and what you've, I mean, you said your brain rewired itself.
That's exactly what happened. So I was, my mother had started teaching me my ABCs and one, two, you know, I was learning to count and learning just to do my ABCs. And when I was in the hospital, she would bring things in for me to play with. And, you know, I'm a kid, right? So trying to give me things. And I could no longer do that. I could no longer write my ABCs, which I could do well before that.
Uh-huh.
But I could sculpt anything out of Play-Doh. She'd put Play-Doh in front of me, and I could just go, boom, like
wow.
that. So somehow my brain rewired itself, and to this day, I can sculpt anything.
Yeah.
I went out in the snow 6 weeks ago, and we had a big snow. I asked my daughter what she would like me to make. So she said a unicorn. So I did a unicorn in about 30 minutes. My wife took a picture of it.
You'll have to send us a picture and, so we can show everybody the unicorn. Oh, my gosh. You did that in 30 minutes?
About 30 wow. minutes, yeah. And that's big. That's well, about that's
We
about
don't
this.
Want to show you our snowman.
No,
that is incredible.
30 minutes. No pictures, no nothing.
Yeah.
I can see everything. My photographic memory is truly photographic.
Yeah.
I can see everything. I don't write. I draw words.
So the brain injury in
a
way.
Letters. And okay. I can't write very much. A little bit. It took me.
What an amazing talent that developed from this tragic instance. And the fact that your family was in metalsmithing before.
Yes.
So you're fifth generation.
I'm a fifth generation metalsmith.
How did your family
William Kukovich the sixth.
Uh-huh.
And my family immigrated here in 1942 from Poland, Russia area, 42, 43-ish.
Uh-huh.
First born in America.
Yeah. So he brought the talent from Poland.
They did. They brought nothing but some hammers. And some photographs. I have all of those.
How amazing.
I have a Damascus steel hammerhead that my great-great-great-grandfather made. Forged himself.
Wow.
And I started metalsmithing when I was about 12. And by the time I was 16, I was really good at it.
Yeah.
I'm not good at almost anything else. But
no,
I'm
but
really
you can say you're good at this because you are.
Yes.
So, was your family? Did your family have a jewelry store?
No.
Did you? No.
They did. You know, back in Europe.
Uh-huh.
But in those times, you have to remember, being a metalsmith, being a jeweler, didn't mean that you made rings all the time. You made candelabras.
Exactly.
You made
bell
sconces.
Yeah.
You did anything. You know. Anything in metal. You made swords. You were fixing everything. They made guns, you know, back in these times when guns were all handmade, you know, before they were manufacturing these. So they were doing a little bit of everything. And when they moved here, the war was ending and there was no work. The economy was not, you know, there wasn't a lot of jewelry, you know, there wasn't a lot of this going on. So
no one had extra money. Everything was put into the war effort. Yeah, absolutely.
So they moved to Kansas, southeast Kansas, where there's one of the few coal sources, anthracite coal, which is the black stuff, like almost like jet. And then there's lignite, which is what we burn in most places, which is more of a gray slate that they grind up and blow into a furnace. But to get this anthracite out is much more difficult, and it's more of a vein type thing.
Okay.
So they hand forged. They were there as metalsmiths. They didn't go into the coal mines. They were there as metalsmiths, building small tools, fixing things, doing anything like that, building anything metalsmithing related to this. And everything was small because it had to be small because these guys were going in small holes and even hand forging drill bits and, you know, all sorts of things like that.
Wow.
Back then.
So take us through your story where you have your brain injury at the age of 4. You start metalsmithing.
At 16.
You're really good by the age of 16.
Mm-hmm.
Where from there?
From there, I started apprenticing for a little jewelry store in southeast Kansas, Lavery's Jewelers. And I did a little bit there, but I was far above. You know, they were Stellar didn't exist then, but they were kind of a parts and pieces put together, not real custom like we do now. I went to Texas Institute of Jewelry Technology in Paris, Texas.
Okay.
And in my first, I still talk to those guys. They're up there right now. And Ulla Rouse was my professor, and she was a strict German lady, you know.
Yep.
And in my first semester, when I first got there, they pulled me out of class and we had a long meeting about whether they should just push me through because I was, I'd been doing this so long and it's all I could do. So again, I don't want that to sound, I don't want that to come across in this way.
But it was a talent.
You had a natural born talent that.
You can see the pictures of my work. And I could do this.
Yeah.
So, and I can't do much else. I'll keep saying that when we talk about.
Your work is exceptional. It's gorgeous. And after school, did you go and open up your own store immediately? Or
like all immigrants, they want their children to do something other than they did.
Yeah.
So. You know, I like to say that every day I'm not a doctor. I'm disappointing my mother. But
I have the same thing with my grandma. I was to go to school to become a doctor or a lawyer. Mm-hmm. In fact, she named my dad Michael Don Pincock, M.D. Pincock. Like she was giving him like all these like subliminal messages to be a doctor. I get it. I totally
That's
get
hilarious.
It.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not a doctor, Grandma, and I am so sorry. It's not going to happen. But anyway, okay. So you're not a doctor.
So I got my 4-year degree from Stephen F. Austin University.
Uh-huh.
And at that time I had become a gemologist. So my gemology degree went right along with geology and Stephen F. Austin. So I kind of just picked the easiest thing to get a 4-year degree in because I truly felt like it was a waste of time.
Yeah.
But my family
you knew what you loved to do.
I love it as a hobby, but I it's never done anything before. You know, I do this for a living.
Yeah.
So, and after that, I worked for a small jewelry store and they were very kind and took me in one day and said, you know, you're just too talented for this place. In Nacogdoches, Texas, we're going to help you find a place for you.
How amazing.
And so they helped me find a place. It was in Durham, North Carolina, Raleigh-Durham Chapel Hill, which is the Research Triangle. There was a woman there who was very interested in jewelry. She had inherited a lot of money. She wanted to start a real metalsmithing shop, and there really weren't that many people out there, and there still aren't. There's less now than there was then.
Absolutely.
That could come in and do that, and she gave me that opportunity at 20. She hired me when I was 20 years old, and I'll never forget because I fibbed at the interview and said I was 21. Because I thought I was a few months from being 20.
Yeah.
But, you know, I thought legal drinking age will make me seem much more mature.
Much more mature. So. Yeah, you can go out for a beverage. Yeah.
So she hired me, brought me in, and I built a large shop for her, hired 7 metalsmiths, taught them, you know, pretty much everything I knew.
Yeah.
I was a terrible manager back then because I was a kid.
Yeah.
So no one wants a 21-year-old kid bossing you what to do when you're 50.
Yeah.
And, but there's not much they could do about it. But I learned how to manage at a young age.
Yeah.
And then when I was 26, I had this lump in my chest that was really hurting. You know, didn't know what it was, thought it would go away. I was, you know, Durham is the city of medicine. I went to the doctor. I said, you know, I got this lump in my chest, you know, one here. And I've got like a couple little small ones here. And he said, oh, you know, I'm gonna send you to it. We're not going to freak out about this, but we're going to send you to a specialist.
Yeah.
And at Duke University. They sent me in and he looked at me. He said, yeah, we're going to set you up for, they did a biopsy. They brought it back that day. He said, we're going to set you up for surgery on Monday. I said, surgery on Monday? For what?
Yeah.
He said, breast cancer. So I had breast cancer when I was 26 years old.
26.
26, yeah. And so I went in, which was also happens to be the year I won my first Spectrum Award, one of 17 that I have.
Yeah.
Took me in, removed it from both chests.
Chemo and radiation and
no
all
chemo,
that?
No radiation. That was, they believed they got it all.
Uh-huh.
And I could have opted for chemo. My dad did, and he went through chemo, but they didn't. It was an option.
It wasn't a necessity.
It wasn't because I was so with men, they get it. They find it earlier. They get it earlier. You don't have all the glands in the breast that women do.
Yeah.
So
slightly less common.
Yes. But I never spoke about it. I didn't tell my mother or father, anyone in my family, except for 10 years. I did that all by myself and never told a single family member about it. And I don't know why. I don't have an answer.
They didn't even know you went in for surgery?
They didn't know. No one knew. I did it all on my own.
That's incredible.
No one in my family knew.
Wow.
I've told this story before, this portion of this on NPR. I, to this day, get 5 to 6 emails from cancer survivors saying, I loved you talking about this because I've never spoken about it either. And I don't know why either, because I don't have an answer for you why I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I went in for an interview in my hometown, kind of a hometown boy makes good interview.
Yeah.
And the woman, when I sat down with her at a cafe, she had a do-rag on and no eyebrows. And I, you know.
You could tell. Yeah.
And I said, what's going on? And she said, breast cancer. And I just
opened up
and told her my whole story. She wrote about it. Did not turn into a hometown boy made good. It turned into a hometown boy gets breast cancer in 20, you know, 26.
Not what you're expecting, yeah.
And my mother got the Morning Sun newspaper the next day, and I was in town visiting my family, and I drove to her house, and I walked in the door, and she smacked me.
Yeah.
Still gets to me this day. So angry about it, but anyway.
Dude, I cried in my interview too.
Yeah.
So and she cried in her job interview.
So
oh my God. You got the job?
She got the job. Yeah.
She cried in her interview. She's like, I don't know why I'm doing this.
I don't even remember the question.
I think it was like where do you see yourself in 5 years or why do you want this position?
Yeah.
I think it's like why do you want this position or something like that. But
well, that one always gets me.
Yeah.
Because my mother was so hurt and angry.
No, I
you didn't let her be there for you.
Absolutely.
That's what family's for, is to be there for you.
But I can see, I can also see where you're coming from as you wanted to protect them from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because they'd already gone through so much, I think, with what happened to you in the past and that it was maybe kind of your way of protecting them from another heartache that they would have to go through. So, I mean, I can see it and I understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from an outsider looking in, it makes sense from both mm-hmm. standpoints. You understand how your mother was very upset, but you can also understand why... You know, you've been through so many medical things for so long that it's like, I don't want to put my parents through one more.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people don't talk about cancer. That's what I found out after that interview.
Yeah.
All these people write to me and say, this same thing happened to me. Or it happened to someone I know and they didn't tell us until the very end, right before they died. Or this. And a lot of people, it is not unique to me.
Yeah.
No.
It is unique that I spoke about this,
mm-hmm.
but it is not unique to me, is what we found out. I get more people wrote in about that than anything.
That's crazy.
And I do a line of rings, just warrior rings like these.
I love those.
And I do pink sapphires instead of the diamonds.
Yeah.
But I do these for cancer survivors because I always hated that stupid ribbon. A ribbon is not a warrior's weapon.
It is not.
And anybody who's gone through cancer knows that is a warrior's game.
Yeah.
That is not a light. That is not a pink ribbon.
You are a survivor.
It's ridiculous.
Yes.
And it drives me crazy.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, but why do that?
I get it. And when I worked retail and it was, you know, we have this for breast cancer, you know, a little pink ribbon-y thing. And they were like, and so we would.
What else can we do?
And so we do a lot of pink sapphire rings mm-hmm. or something like that that they could have as their, I conquered this, because that's what it is. You're conquering something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's best to get them when you're going through it, it is what jewelry is about. We attach emotions to this.
Absolutely.
That's what it is. And absolutely, the engagement ring is the best example of that. Everyone's engagement ring is different, but everyone, it's the same thing is attached to every one of those. It's marriage. It's a commitment that you're making to one another. And so they don't need to look like a certain thing. And everything I make, I try to, for someone, I really try to attach that, whatever this occasion is for them, and it almost always is an occasion for them,
right.
I want to attach that to the jewelry.
Yeah.
And 91% of our gross sales are custom out of my store. That's a huge number for custom jewelry. Yeah.
It is.
And the reason is I think we could sell more out of the cases, but I just can't seem to let that happen. Every time someone tells me what that occasion is, I just want to make them something that means something, or that reminds them.
And as a metalsmith and a maker, you're part of their story now. Yeah. You've told their story through your jewelry, through your art.
Yeah.
And it's... now I'm going to cry.
Let's all cry.
But that's what it is, and getting to help people tell their story, and it's going to live forever.
Mm-hmm.
Their love, their commitment, it's going to live forever.
And it will live forever. Yeah. I work on pieces of jewelry that my great 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 grandfather made.
Yeah.
I work on things that go that long. That's why we were talking earlier about what am I purchasing here? Mainly corundum.
Yeah.
Mainly corundum.
Sapphire.
Why do I buy corundum? Comes in every color of the rainbow, first of all. But it lasts forever. And my jewelry lasts forever. When you're doing custom work, you don't care about gold. What's it going to cost? $50 more or something like that?
Yes, exactly.
So you make it heavy. You make it right. You make it last for forever.
Yeah.
And corundum will last that way. But a tanzanite won't.
Exactly.
Right, and so I don't like to sell anything that won't last forever. I want to leave more than a coffee table book.
Yeah,
I want to leave a legacy.
A legacy, and
something.
You do that. Yeah. You do that with each person you interact. Any person that owns a piece of your jewelry, I feel like a part of your soul almost to an extent, because you put the effort and the energy behind creating that piece specifically for them.
Yeah, it's all I have.
Yeah.
I as I said earlier, I there's not much else I can do. You know, I can't read my kids' bedtime stories.
Yeah.
You want to cry.
Yeah.
You know, that'll do it to you.
Yeah.
Because I just can't read that well.
Yeah.
My 8-year-old reads better than I do.
Yeah.
And spells better than I do. There are things I can't do in this world, but I can...
You can make
can
a make beautiful
a,
piece
I can
of
make
jewelry.
A, yeah. A unicorn. That unicorn got picked up by the local school principal called me and said, "Oh, can we put this on our website for the snow day?"
Yeah.
You know, I had a picture of Veda in it, my daughter. And I said, "Sure." She said, "Can you take one without Veda in it, just because?"
Of course,
And that's why you don't realize the size, but it's this big, you know?
Yeah.
And so she put it on there, and then on Facebook, and then my wife put it on Facebook. They put it on the school thing. Then our local news channel picked it up from there. And then it was on the late show, Jimmy Fallon.
Oh, my gosh.
It was that same station. It was the affiliate.
Yeah.
So it was on that. Well, can you imagine, out of all the snow we've had and all the snow sculptures,
no one has made a unicorn but me? That was
pretty amazing. I haven't seen a unicorn. How popular are unicorns this year?
Exactly.
They're everywhere, but no one made a unicorn?
Exactly.
My daughter's like, make a unicorn. And my kids just don't. They have me do this all the time. My daughter will hand me clay, anything, and tell me to make something, and I do it. And they act like it's nothing. They're like, thanks, Dad. Walk over. I made her that. I was like, oh, I made it. Come on, you want to get a picture? No, I'm busy. You know, I'm like, oh, you know. Exactly. They don't even.
They will one day.
That's for sure.
So we were talking, 26, you get cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Happens to be the same year you win your first Spectrum Award.
And those go hand in hand.
Yeah.
That was, I was blessed with cancer at a young age. The blessing is the age I got it at, not the cancer.
Yeah.
Surviving it was a blessing, but the age. I everyone knows you're gonna that they're gonna die. We all know it. But it's one of those things that you don't really think about, like, you don't
know. In your 20s, you don't know, you feel immortal. Like, there's
the
yeah.
cliche of live to live like you are dying happens after you almost die.
Yeah.
And I've almost died several times.
Yeah.
and after cancer, at 26, I have lived like I could die at any moment. And it changed my life. I've done everything. I completely different. Everything in my life changed after that. I did whatever I wanted. As long mm-hmm. as I'm not hurting anybody, I do whatever I want to do.
You express yourself without regard. I mean, for what could... You don't hold yourself back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the reason it is a blessing is the age. At 75, you will do the same thing. But you have a much shorter time period to do it.
Yeah.
So
yeah, because my grandma gets away with saying things that she would have never said like 20 mm-hmm. years ago. You're like, oh, grandma, and she'll just say whatever the heck she wants to say because she doesn't care.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I became more open. I was not this gregarious. I speak my mind more.
Yeah.
I would ask any girl out. There was no girl that was, you know,
no.
They just tell me, no, I just move on to another way.
Yeah.
No, no, yeah. No. Well, how about, is this your sister? How about that?
That's great. So, what inspired that first winner? Was it made before or after the cancer diagnosis?
It was the first time I called myself a designer.
Mm-hmm.
Even my business cards, I would not put designer on them. I would put metalsmith.
Yeah.
And I did not consider myself an artist or a designer or at that time. I believe I was. Other people told me I was. But I was too... There was something in me that I wouldn't embrace that.
Yeah.
And I was partly ashamed of it. There was something about it that felt almost unmasculine, especially when you grow up in a household of metalsmiths, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
People who, I mean, we're strong. I mean, these people can't see me, but I'm not a little guy, right? I mean, I'm...
And metalsmith sounds more...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to do that. This felt feminine or something like that. And after that, I was like, screw this.
I'm a designer.
I'm a designer. By saying it, I became it.
Yeah.
You know, I became it by verbalizing it. I became that. So that's
and so what was the piece?
It was a green Savarite garnet in 18 karat yellow and platinum with a little channel. It was asymmetrical. Asymmetry is tough because you have to do balance, you know.
Yes.
Symmetry is symmetry, but asymmetry has to be asymmetry with balance.
Absolutely.
And I won that year with that piece.
So this is a question that we ask anybody we interview. What is your first memory that you can remember of gemstones or jewelry? So if you think back, that one memory you have that just stuck with you, like, I like this. I like this stuff.
That's easy for me. My father went to Australia when I was very young. My parents were divorced when I fell out of the back of that truck. And my father came back from Australia because I was going to die. Right?
Okay.
They thought that for sure. And he brought for me at that time a little box, black box that I still have, of sapphires and opals that he had
from Australia.
From Australia that he had dug, and we have pictures of him in the outback, you know, his shirt off, digging, you know, whatever. And he gave those to me in the hospital. You know, I remember getting those in the hospital, and I put them away. I've never used them. They're in the same box, the same order, the same thing. It's one of these, you know, these little flip open, kind of leather covered, snap down box, you know, and they're not particularly beautiful, but they're certainly what I remember. My first memory of gemstones and this, and I developed a love for those. They were my most treasured possession. And I would take them and put them in a box, and I would bury them and draw a treasure map to them. And when I was a kid, and
how awesome is that?
Then I would go dig them up, and then I'd follow the treasures. Yeah, and I'm I remember losing the treasure map sometimes, and I would have to go dig in the 12 places where I always buried and find them. I played with them all the time, and I carried them around with me often, you know. Yeah. And I've never not had them in my possession, no matter where I've lived or what I've done. When I went to, they've never not been in my possession wherever I'm at.
That's crazy. So, favorite gemstone?
Favorite gemstone?
Yeah,
certainly sapphires. Sapphire. Corundum.
Corundum.
For sure.
Yeah. In any particular color?
I love green.
Yeah.
I have a collection of greens that are just amazing. I don't know why, but I love green in general. I have 17 Spectrum Awards, and I believe that 12 of them are won with green stones.
Really?
Green-colored stones.
Yeah.
Wow.
Some are tourmaline.
Uh-huh.
You know,
garnets.
Sapphire. Things like that. Yeah. So
when you sit down to design a piece, one of your Spectrum pieces, where do you start the process? Where do you get your inspiration from?
I have been asked that question
a million times.
Well, you know what? You're going to get the most truthful answer, and you're going to get the one that everybody that is true forever.
Yes.
This answer that I'm going to give you is universally true, and I have made up a million sexy answers for that.
Yeah.
I dreamt it.
Yeah.
You know,
a girl's eyes.
Yes. Inspired, you know, all these things. Great jewelry evolves. You start making something, you make it better, it's an evolution.
Yeah.
It doesn't pop into your head one day.
Yep.
You make a piece, then you make it again better and different, and then you make it again better and different, and then you make it again better and different, and you eventually get there.
Yeah.
So it's not a ta-da moment.
Yep.
It's a slow process, and I believe all great designers do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you normally start with the stone and say, hey, this is the stone I really want to make something for? Or do you have... Does the metal come first for you, and then you find the stone that'll fit in that mounting?
Well, the design comes first
for you,
for me, okay. But I won't build the design. I'll find the design will come to you know. I'll be evolving the design, and then I will find the stone, and then I'll put the design. You know, put
and
the
then
two
you'll
together,
marry them together.
Obviously, but I always the design for me. Design is first. Metalsmithing and design is where it all starts.
Because for a lot of designers, it's the other way around.
Yeah.
That's why I was curious. I would say more often for you, Brecken,
I start with the stone.
Yeah, you start with the stone.
Sure.
So that's what I thought with, as a metalsmith.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
The stone is only a part of the design.
Yeah.
Right.
That's all it is for me. It's
sure.
just like, it's,
yeah.
it's just a, and it's not, and it's a small part.
Yeah.
Of the design for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I,
well,
the
yeah,
design
from
is
your
the,
work,
is the
absolutely.
Piece. Yeah.
You're more into the metal.
Yeah. Even though it's significant. It'll be the centerpiece, but to me, that's a much smaller.
It's just one element.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
I think all, to go along with that question, I've been asked before, What makes a great designer? What do you think does this? You know, I think every great designer was told that they were terrible and worthless at this. And then they were also told that they were the second coming of Christ. And they believed both.
Yeah.
You have to believe both.
Yeah. It
you
is.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I totally understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You can't believe.
You have greatness without failure.
Oh, you need a chip on your shoulder, and then you need to nail it. You know what I mean? You need it. You need to have a I'll show you attitude. I'm competitive, very competitive. I do not like. Losing.
I'm Brecken. I mean, the same.
I like winning.
Yeah.
But I hate losing.
Yeah.
I win because I hate losing, not because I like winning.
Totally. So we have this, we do trade shows, right? And there's this cocktail party at one of the shows where we have to design a showcase. Yes, I am. And I, like you, do not like to lose, but I also understand I can't win every time or it's not fun for everyone else involved. But we lost last time. And so now I have to redeem myself.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this is like in my veins right now. Mm-hmm.
No pressure.
Yeah, I've got Stephanie helping me and I'm like, this will happen. We will do this. So I get it. I get it totally. So where are you now? now. You're custom designing. You have a store.
Mm-hmm.
What's the name? Where can people find you?
William Travis Jewelry. My location is Chapel Hill, North Carolina. My store's, it's 4,500 square feet. And half of that is devoted to shop and staff spacing. There's a place there called SAS, and there's a which is ranked as one of the top places to work in the world.
Uh-huh.
And it was started by Mr. Goodnight, the Goodnight family, Mr. Goodnight's SAS, and he has been a mentor to me. I feel like one of the things that I learned, or that came out of the head injury, all those things, is listening to people.
Mm.
I really want to listen. I will take advice from many. I mean, I won't always use that advice,
sure.
But
I
want,
and I have to be good at that to do what I do. But I'm thirsty for knowledge. I want to listen. I want to hear. I want to know what you know.
Yeah.
And he's been a mentor to me, and he taught me that it's not enough to be a good boss. You have to actively seek their happiness.
Yeah.
Actively seek their happiness. And I thought that was brilliant. So I have a big bar in my shop, you know,
nice.
12-foot, nice rounded bar, full stocked. I have a big kitchen area. My entire career, I ate at my bench.
Yeah.
And that's a terrible thing to do to somebody, or at their desk.
Yeah.
I have a full kitchen. Now, this is retail space. This cost me a lot of money to do this.
Yes.
But I devote all of this space and energy into designing their dream area.
Yeah.
And because of that, I have low turnover.
Yeah.
With people. I mean, I've had people. I mean, there's always some.
People's lives change.
And there's some positions that are lower, that where you know you're hiring them so that they can grow, and you know they're going to grow out of that position.
Yep.
And so that's always going to turn over relatively quickly. But important people stay with me for, 10, 15 years. And, I believe that's why. I mean, we really try to treat them. I'm actively seeking their happiness.
Yeah.
You know.
And that's the best way to do it. Yeah. Shows you care. Not just about, you know, your bottom line at the end of the day. You want to make people's lives better.
That's right. Well, it does help the bottom line.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it
does.
Certainly does. I mean,
yeah.
I'm achieving both by doing this.
Yeah.
Employees will do anything.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So what's next for you? Where is this journey going to take you next?
I do a line for the North Carolina Museum of Art.
Uh-huh.
When they were building our new Museum of Art, I went there with one of my clients who is one of their big supporters. You know,
uh-huh.
And I couldn't afford to do anything for them. So I said, you know, this is so inspirational. I want to do something for the North Carolina Museum of Art to raise money, you know, because I can't write them a big check.
Yes.
So at that time, my daughter was taking every beetle out of the pool. You know, out of my pool would take beetles, you know, and play with it. Loved them. You know, they would be dead, but she'd be like, look how pretty this is, Dad. So I captured every scarab beetle in North Carolina from my pool. I just found out what all of them were, and I happened to catch them all. And I dried them out on my oven, and I poured plaster around, you know, cast them, filled. I raised bees. I filled every little crevice with beeswax, and I cast all of the North Carolina scarab beetles in precious metal and set some stones in them and donated them to the North Carolina Museum of Art. And I think that there were 12 or
uh-huh.
something. And I think we raised 15,000, 20,000. Don't quote, but it was a check that I couldn't write. Right?
Absolutely.
And then what we found out when I was being interviewed for that was that the scarab is the oldest piece of jewelry still in production. It was one of the first ones made, and it's still in production to this day. But in that time period, no one had ever used, they couldn't find anyone through history who had used the actual
cast, the actual
bug as the mold. I reinvented the oldest piece of jewelry.
Yeah.
And now people do it all the time.
Fishing beetles out of your swimming pool.
I didn't do it on purpose, but, you know.
That's cool.
It's my daughter's job to get out there every morning and take, there's live toads and dead bugs. And, and frogs. And she, I live, you know, we live out of town a little bit in the country. So there's always tree frogs, toads, and bugs in there. So every morning she goes out there and rescues.
Yeah.
She calls it toad rescue.
Toad rescue.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, yeah.
Livy yeah. would love that.
Livy would love Toad Rescue. Yeah. We have 3-year-old twins.
Oh, wow. And so, jeez. Yeah. Do I say congratulations? I don't know. Is that?
Yes. It's busy. It's busy, but they're good girls. They're here. They're with Grandma back at the hotel, and they're having a grand time. They went to the park today because it was finally nice outside, not freezing cold or raining. Uh-huh. But, yeah, it's fun. So do your kids – well, do they show any interest in what you do?
They do. People say, oh, would you be – you're a fifth generation, and would you be disappointed if your children didn't go into this? And I say, of course I would. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not really even going to give them that choice.
Yeah?
I mean, I'm going to pretend that I'm giving them that choice, but I'm not giving them that choice.
I think, though, when you have passion for something, you share that. It bleeds. Because Jonathan had no intention of joining the family biz. And it just kind of... He had to make that discovery on his own. But once he said, I love this, there was no turning back. Because his dad and his mom... instilled the passion.
Well, I think that's common. That's kind of a rebellious, I'm not going to do what you do.
I'm going into computers, Dad. Forget your gemstones.
I tell them they can do anything. You can be a lawyer. We need lawyers at William Travis Jewelry. You can be a cat, you know, whatever.
You could be my, if you want to be my doctor.
At William Travis Jewelry.
You're going to be there.
That's where you're going to do it, you know?
Yeah.
13 and 8.
Oh, how great.
13 year old son.
So you have him like sleeping up in the shop?
William.
I don't.
They're too young. They're in there. They're too young to really. I want to be careful how I bring them in, I bring them in. I want them to have fun with it.
Yeah.
And you know, they know what Daddy does. You know, of course. But I want to be careful with that. And I think 13 is he's about. I think my son is about the right age. I really think 16 is a little better. And now he's he wants to go ice skating and play with his friends.
He only wants to hear with you some of the time.
Yeah,
I think parents that push their kids too hard to start too young, that's when they rebel and don't want to do it. Is it's like if you say, hey, you're going to start sitting the bench.
That's right.
He's like, I'm out.
Yeah. I think you wait till they show a little spark of interest, and then you encourage it. And I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So. And I never showed any interest, and so my dad never encouraged. Mm. So I just...
Well, no, I don't think that's true. He worked, in computers.
I worked in the company on computers, so he took what I was interested in and let me work in the family business. Mm-hmm. But he never pushed me towards what he really did in the business.
No.
So, like you said, he didn't care where I ended up, and he didn't know that he had... Really ask him that in his interview. If he ever thought I was going to join the business, and if he knew, he always said that we could do whatever we wanted, but he never.
You always say like that, right? My parents said that to me too.
Yeah. Then it was your grandma.
Grandma pushed me.
Grandma did not want you to do anything you wanted.
No, but she liked Jonathan and she likes jewelry, so it was a nice combo.
Now she's impressed.
Yeah,
Grandma.
She is.
I have this philosophy in my business that I never say no. I always say yes. Yes is the answer. And I think that's a popular thing now. Recently, I've been doing it my entire career, ever since I had got breast cancer. Along with that. So I think it's a valuable lesson. You know, not maybe or what would that look like? You just say yes because you can always say no later.
Yeah.
You know, but your answer, keep it going. Get it going. And from that, so many opportunities have popped up in my life, and I think that you could call it luck, but it's making your own luck.
Yeah.
I had a gentleman come in my store one day and sit down at a table. I have many stories like this, but this one is particularly good. But I have a bunch. We could do a whole podcast on that. This story. But he sat down and he put his feet up on my design table. His wife came in one day, looked at the jewelry. She says, oh, my God, I love this. We travel all over the world. I've never seen anything like your stuff. You're here in Chapel Hill. We're big boosters at Chapel Hill. We own an apartment here so we can just come in for games. My husband's coming. I'm going to bring him in tomorrow. So she did. People say that all the time, and they never do. But she did. And he came in, and he put his feet up on my design desk, which annoyed me immediately. Yes. You know?
Oh,
and
wow.
Then he got his phone out, and he was just on his phone. And if you can't tell by now, I'm excitable, right, about my stuff. You know, yeah. So she starts looking around, and she's just picking out. She has seen a lot of jewelry. She's nailing it. She's grabbed my best pieces and bringing them over to him. And he would look up from his phone for a split second, nod yes, and then go right back to it. And then she would put it over there in the pile. And they ended up buying a lot of stuff. I mean, it was a huge purchase.
Yeah.
$30,000, $50,000. I don't know. It was a lot.
Yeah.
And as I'm ringing him up, I just couldn't hold it in any longer. I was just, because this was bothering me the whole time, right? But I was wanting to make, you know, I'm smiling with her.
Absolutely.
But I just couldn't do it. And I knew, and I'm looking at that pile of jewelry, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm going to screw this sale up. But I said, excuse me, sir. What was your name again? Rusty, was that Rusty? And he turned to me, and I said, you know, you're not just getting anything here. These pieces are handmade. I'm a fifth generation metalsmith. You're getting the highest quality jewelry in the world, I believe. And you're getting great design. And I can prove it because most of these pieces are all award winning pieces. And these are just, you know, you're really getting great stuff here. This is not nothing. And he had his phone, you know, and he tripped the way and he looked at me. You could tell it shocked him, right? And he said, what came out of his mouth, that just surprised me because the only thing he said, he said, I just bought a place in Costa Rica, a resort in Costa Rica. How would you like to design a line of jewelry for me? And I said, yeah, I'd love to do that. And then he just went right back to his phone.
What? Just like,
that's
just
all
like
he
that.
Said. That's all he said. You know, and when he looked at me, I thought he was going to say, well, that, you know, don't you know? Speak to, he had an ego, obviously. He wouldn't be
sure,
doing that. But that's all he said.
Yeah.
And I didn't say maybe. I didn't say, what would that look like? I said, yes.
Yeah.
And his people a week later called and flew my wife and I, private jet out to Costa Rica, a place called Flor Blanca.
Uh-huh.
It's 13 little villas on the Coya Peninsula. It's in all the guidebooks, it's listed as the most luxurious resort in all of Costa Rica. We did that deal on a handshake. I've been doing it for 8 years, 10 years now with him. And we did it on a handshake, never signed a contract, nothing. He pays for all the materials. I build all the jewelry. We send it down there, and we split the profit. And it's just that easy. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah,
I make whatever I want.
Because he said yes.
And he said, because I said yes.
Yeah.
Sure. And,
does he still come into your shop?
Oh, yeah. He comes in all the time.
Does he put his feet up on the desk?
Sometimes. But I don't really mind anymore.
Yeah, you don't mind. I wouldn't mind either.
You don't mind either.
Honestly, he sets at the bar now. He sets at the bar, to be quite honest.
That's
so,
great.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
Yeah. That is a good story. Travis, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. Incredible to see the transformation that your life took from one single traumatic episode and incident, and how you've kind of taken what some could see as a disadvantage and created something beautiful with it, and that you get to share that with everyone now.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you allowing me to share.
Yeah, and as I get misty-eyed again, gosh. I'm
this is the tearjerker episode.
I'm inspired by you and what you do, and I wish you nothing but the best. Oh, and 17 more Spectrum Awards, I hope. And we'll definitely keep in touch and keep up with you and watch what you do.
Thank you. I would love to do this again sometime.
Wonderful. Great. Well, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Gem Junkies. I'm Brecken.
And Jonathan.
And if you want to see what we do in our real life, you can always follow us at Parlay Gems on Instagram or Facebook. We'll talk to you another time. Bye.
Bye.